I'm Gray Watson. I'm with Chris Burden in the Tate Gallery on a day when his new installation there is opening. The installation is called When Robots Rule the Two-Minute Airplane Factory. You could describe it briefly.
Sure. In the central galleries, the Dubin galleries of the Tate, there's a automated robotic production line, assembling line as it were, that produces a small stick and tissue rubber band powered airplane. And the plane, after being built by the machine, is actually launched by the machine, and it flies up in the octagon space in a circular pattern and eventually lands on the floor and is retrieved by attendants, and it's for sale to the public for £5. An airplane comes off the end of the production line one every 2 minutes, and hence the title, When Robots Rule, the Two-Minute Airplane Factory.
And it's your idea that people will fly these planes and they'll get stuck in trees and God knows where and litter London, and that has a certain aesthetic appeal, yeah?
Well, that's my hope. My hope is that they step out onto the front of the Tate steps and immediately try to fly them right outside the Tate, and that outside the Tate there would be a lot of littered and crashed airplanes as a sort of a sign as to what's happening inside.
Sure. Now, these planes are a very slightly modified version of a toy airplane called the Rizoff Grand, is that right? The ROG. And you can buy these as toy airplanes for sort of for personal assembly, hand assembly.
What you get in a kit is a set of plans, a bundle of sticks, and a little tissue, and a rubber band and a propeller.
You decided to modify the design very slightly for your factory assembly line here in the Tate. Could you just say why?
For a couple of reasons. One was a financial one, because every time the machine has to make a part that's not a right angle, it costs 30,000 more pounds to put that angle into the machine. So by eliminating a couple of the angles, we save 90,000 pounds in the production of the machine. That's one reason. Another reason is because the fuselage stick has been slightly shortened. It was found that fully wound, the kit model has a tendency to bend the fuselage stick, so we shorten the stick a little bit just to make it stiffer. And let me think of some of the other modifications. We actually don't use the tissue paper that is supplied with the kit. We've gone to using teabag paper. And the reason for that was that when you make the planes by hand, you use a little brush and you use a dilute of 50% glue and 50% water. The problem with the machine was that the roller brushes had a tendency to skim over and dry up. And upon investigation, we found that tea bags are made by machines that spit them out 4,000 a minute. And there's a little bit of polyethylene coating on the tea bag paper, and it's heat sensitive. In other words, if you heat it and clamp it together, it glues to itself. So we adapted that technology to attach the paper to the wooden spars.
Great. Now, you've used these planes before, but handmade. But you've assembled the kit many times yourself, for your own pleasure, as a child, presumably.
No, not as a child. As an adult, I've used them. And I've used them in my artworks. So about 4 or 5 years ago, as I was daydreaming, I fantasized a machine that could do what your hand does. And I knew that would be quite a tall order, to make a machine that duplicates your hand-eye coordination. And initially, I planned to build that machine myself. And when I was invited here to the Tate to do a project in the Dubin Galleries, part of the problem is dealing with that immense, awkward space. And how does the sculptor address that? How do you compete with the architecture, basically? I knew the little plane, the ROG, would certainly fly in that space quite well. And at that point, I proposed the factory to the Tate, the robotic factory.
You've never made it before?
It's never been made before, no.
In the little essay you wrote accompanying it, you talked about the tedious manual eye-hand dexterity, suggesting that it was really rather a bore having to do it so slowly, and that, you know, the mass production was a great relief. Do you also feel, on the other hand, a slight sense of regret, a slight loss of the hand touch?
No, not at all. One is fun, two is okay, but by the time you've built the 30th or 20th, it's sort of a bore. So no, I don't. That's not the loss I feel. The loss I feel is that I actually wasn't personally involved with the design of the factory, with the design and fabrication of the factory.
You weren't? What happened then?
We hired some art fabricators who are downstairs, so they took my concept and worked it out. I mean, I was involved with them in the sense that okaying the modifications to the plane, but literally in terms of building the factory, I didn't do that.
Why was that? Because you weren't here in England, or was it some other reason?
Time frame.
Yeah.
I was involved in another project. I was building a large series of Meccano bridges, and in 9 months, there's no way on earth I could build that factory.
Right.
So
it was a very complex operation, apparently. Yeah.
Still is.
There are, at the time of speaking, I think, very slight problems. Things aren't quite working as they should be. In fact, when I was last there, the planes weren't being made. What are the problems, do you know?
Oh, some of it's a computer problem, software problem. Some of it, I think there's a bad motor drive on one of the assembly lines. But it's basically just a scheduling problem. It's not really a problem. It's just that there's a date that was an arbitrary date that was chosen by the Tate, and it was anticipated that we could meet that deadline, but obviously we couldn't. So it's a couple days behind schedule, but hopefully in the next day or two it should be operating.
Sure it will. Now, your father was an engineer, and most of the answers you've given so far have been quite technical answers. Well, I asked you quite straightforwardly technical questions. Did you ever want to be an engineer yourself?
No.
A simple answer. But you have nevertheless, it seems, inherited certain interests from your father, yeah?
Yeah, but I think the interest is one of just interest in the world in general. I'll tell you a little story. One time when I was building a work called the Big Wheel, which is a massive 3-ton flywheel, an antique actually left over from the turn of the century. And I made into a sculpture by attaching a motorcycle to it, and the rider of the motorcycle drives the motorcycle with the rear wheel touching this big metal cast iron wheel that weighs 3 tons. And the rider drives the motorcycle through the gears as if they were accelerating, and that takes a minute at most, and shuts the bike off. And that energy is transferred to the big cast iron wheel, which then spins for 3 hours.
On its own momentum.
So it's nothing really more than an enlarged top. I went to an engineer and was asking him about the timbers because it's all supported in a sort of cradle-like structure. So I went to a turbine engineer and I asked, because I was concerned about how big the lumber should be, and his answer was, well, if it looks right, that's what you use. If it looks about right, then that should do it.
I think so. Almost like an aesthetic sort of.
Right. There's a certain aesthetic to it that if it's good engineering, and then it's usually good aesthetics too. Like I've noticed on the DC-10 airplane, if you look at the tail section, there's a motor that's embedded in the tail. And then there's a big flat panel that's really not part of the tail. And you look at it and you realize it was an afterthought, that they stuck it on afterwards when obviously there wasn't enough tail service. But if you look at it, it looks awkward. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously, in my mind, an engineering faux pas.
I always keen on planes, and that carried on. And also on cars and trains.
Yeah, I guess so, I am. Because those are the things that affect us physically. I mean, the car is actually the most mundane consumer item that's been produced, but the most successful.
The most expensive thing that people own.
Other than their home, yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing how cars serve another function, which is beyond transportation. But cars are clothing, in essence. And they become a surrogate for the individual, too.
So this is part of this much wider interest in the world you mentioned. And is that also the reason you didn't become an architect? Because you trained for a bit as an architect, and I gather you felt it was all a bit too mundane, what you'd have to go through for a long time, or a bit too detailed.
Well, after working in an architectural office for a summer, it appeared to me at the time, which this was over 30 years ago, mind you, that that you had to be about the age I am now, which is in the early 50s, to actually make an important decision. I'm not sure I feel that way now, but at the time, that's what I felt. And whereas when I was in college working in the sculpture department, I could actually work for several weeks or several months and end up with a product. And so I could see immediate results. And that, to me, was more satisfying.
Now, you've talked about this work here, When Robots Rule, as being in some sense a sort of model of the workings of capitalism. I suppose it's a model of the workings of mass production in general, whether capitalist, communist, or anything else.
From a purely industrial capitalist point of view, we've made a factory that costs money, makes a product, we sell the product, we hope that the demand at least meets or exceeds supply. Because if we're about 200 of these airplanes come off the production line every day, one every 2 minutes, or I think seven hours a day or something like that. So if in the first day we only sell 100 planes, then we have 100 left over. The second day, we'd have 200. By the end of the week, we'd have 700. There's a storage problem. So what do you do if demand falls below supply? Do you lower the price? Do you shut down the factory? What do you do? Hopefully, demand exceeds supply. Then we either step up production or raise the price. The planes are selling for £5 each now. About £1 is materials, cost of the wood and the glue and the tissue, propellers. So theoretically, there's £4 of net profit. But you have to remember the factory costs something.
Sure.
So that £4 basically has to go back into paying for the factory. When the factory, when all those individual £4 times 20,000, 50,000, when you get enough of these £4 units that go back into paying for the initial setup cost of the factory, then the factory is paid for. And that's called the break-even point. And then comes the magic moment when every plane coming off the end of the assembly line and every plane that is sold then becomes a pure profit for the owners of the factory.
Sure. So, in fact, the word model works at several levels. They're model planes, but this is a model of a much bigger economic process.
Yeah. I take issue with the fact that they're model planes because
Right. They're
actually not a model of any actual plane that carries passengers. So they're not a model of a P-51 Mustang, not a model. It's a real airplane. You can call it a toy airplane. It's not a model of a larger airplane.
I understand. So that's wrong. But on the other hand, the model in the wider sense, the model of a sort of economic process,
does make sense.
And it enables one, as indeed toys do enable children and adults, to understand processes by playing with them and learning from that play.
Yes. In this day and age, almost everything we handle is made in a factory. Yet that factory is a black box. It's very mysterious as to how these things appear. It's as if by magic. You go to the store, you plunk down your money, and you get one. But how, in fact, I mean, also would be very hard-pressed to make even the simplest consumer item by hand. I mean, Try making your door panel to your car. It's a tough job, and I'm not saying it can't be done, but to hammer out your door and to get the lock to work, tough, tough, tall order. Also, in this day and age, we've become very sort of blasé and cynical about the factory, especially in Great Britain, which was sort of the cradle of the Industrial Revolution. And the factory was seen as, I think, a miracle when it first came on the scene. And we've lost that sort of sense of wonder. We take this for granted now. You could almost call it a nostalgic work, in the sense that I'm trying to relive that reinvent that sense of the miracle of the factory. We should run through the numbers, maybe. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that it takes 4 hours to make one of these planes by hand. You just make one until you get good at it. And we're making, over the total run of the 3 months, we're making something close to 25,000 airplanes. Now, if each one of those planes had to be made by hand, that would mean 100,000 hours, 4 times 25,000, 100,000 hours of labor. To run the factory, it's going to consume somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 hours of attendance time. Let's just say 2,000, be on the high side. Well, if you subtract the 2,000 from the 100,000, you end up with 98,000. So we have saved 98,000 hours of labor by producing this factory.
Some people would argue that we don't need to have the goods and that our lives servicing the machines are less interesting than making things direct. That sort of Luddite type of argument. Does that cut any ice with you at all?
Absolutely. I mean, but that's the flip side of the coin. In this particular instance, I'm trying to celebrate the factory. There is, of course, the problem with industrialism and capitalism, is that it's basically a shell game, a house of cards. So all these economies that are based on growth, endless growth, at some point there's got to be a day of reckoning when the house of cards falls down.
Do you think that's almost certain?
I'm pretty sure it is. There's a finite amount of resources on planet Earth, and that's exactly why we're going out into outer space, to get more raw materials.
Well, that's very interesting, because when you were talking about numbers and the almost sublime sense of numbers and massiveness, I was thinking about the wonder of interstellar spaces and things.
If the moon had just infinite amount of gold, the cost of bringing it back to Earth would exceed the value of the gold itself.
Right.
So the first thing we're going to do is to mine asteroids that are closer to the Earth. That's the first step. I don't think the human psyche is really prepared to deal with outer space. I think there's a lot of optimism, a lot of sort of anticipation that this is going to be a wonderful event. And I have a feeling that it may not be quite so wonderful. In fact, I think it's so damn scary out there that we're going to come running back with our tails between our legs. I think the role of an artist is basically just to step 1 or 2 degrees to the left or the right, just to look at something from a slightly different angle.
Sure. And now you've done that a lot with war, too, a problem within our planet. A lot of your work has dealt with war, isn't that right?
This piece does, too. For example, this could have been Hitler's best fantasy, was to make a factory that could turn out Luftwaffe airplanes at the rate of 1 every 2 minutes. And if he had, we'd be under all Nazi rule right now.
But you say, in fact, the Americans did develop a much faster production scheme for planes than the British Spitfires, is that correct? And that did help the Allied side quite a bit.
It did. It did. So that it was that ability to produce not only airplanes, but the ships that brought all the cargo over. So in answer to all the U-boats, I mean, apparently about a third of the tonnage being shipped over was sunk by U-boats, and until they developed aircraft that could escort the cargo ships far out into the Atlantic. And of course, the invention of radar helped too.
Are you also interested in the psychological causes of war?
If you talk to men who were in World War II, where it was clearly a battle between good and evil, it's actually the highlight of their life. There's nothing like war to make you feel alive.
I think John Dewey said, and I know Norman O'Brien quoted it, the plain truth is that people want war.
Makes them feel, it gives life a real sort of essence, a real, and so you wonder whether war is not something that's sort of built into the human sort of psyche.
And you do think more into the male psyche than the female psyche, don't you?
Oh, I don't. I think females could be certainly as aggressive.
Aggression is a slightly different thing from feeling fully alive. I mean, obviously they're related,
right.
But I wonder if you could unpack that slight distinction.
Well, I think a lot of war is about the feeling that something's going to be taken away from you. That somebody's taking something away from you, be it real estate or livelihood or lifestyle and freedom, quote unquote. I mean, there's a license plate in New Hampshire in the U.S. that says live free or die, which seems absurd to me. I mean, maybe it's better to live under slavery than be dead.
Maybe. So actually a question I was planning to ask you a bit later was whether you felt that the sort of things that you're doing are, in a sense, a way of taking freedom through understanding the processes better and through experiencing them directly, because you're quite interested in personal experience, aren't you?
Yeah.
Maybe we should come at it slightly different way, because I also wanted to ask you quickly, because of my own particular interest in performance, how you feel that what you did as performance work has informed all the work you've done since.
I think a lot of the objects I make now are surrogates for me actually performing. So, for example, you could call this a performative installation, a performative sculpture, because it actually does do something. I think the earlier performances were very personal, in a sense, that they were an attempt to control fate. That I've shifted, in a sense, to sort of an internal inquiry into personal power to an external one of the world and forces around us.
So an investigation into power is a continuing theme.
I think that's a continuous thread, and yeah, that works its way through the work.
Just very briefly, say how you feel that the personal power you were investigating early on relates to the more general social power that you're investigating more now.
Well, I'm not sure this is going to answer the question directly, but everything everybody does is a choice. People tend to lose sight of that, I think. You choose to get up in the morning. You choose to go to work. These are all choices. They're not preordained. There's a few things that are involuntary, breathing, your heart rate.
Well, even breathing you can alter voluntarily.
I mean, yogis can, and people can do it. But basically there's...
Try and breathe water, I believe.
Right, I did. But but most things are an actual choice. And I think lots of them have lost sight of that fact. And it's those choices that give life meaning.
I think that comes close to what I was trying to get at when I talked about the connection between your art and freedom, in a way, because freedom means realizing you have the choices and doing what you do in the consciousness that you could have done otherwise.
There's always a million reasons not to make art. Which, you know, as a professor, an art professor, I can't make art. I can't do this project because I don't have enough money. I don't have a studio. I don't. Well, if you can't figure out a way to make art with anything, then you have a problem, which is that you probably don't want to be an artist.
I think that's quite a suitable point at which to end this interview. And thank you very much indeed, Chris Burton, for your time. That was really great. Thank you very much.
So now I'm in the Laura Vinci Gallery in Paris, talking to the owner and director, Lillian Vinci. So Lillian, before we talk about the current show that you have here, which makes a considerable reference to sound because it's a show of work by Rolf Julius, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the general mission of your gallery, because you have a strong association with sound over the years and artists who make works using sound.
Yes, I think my relation is not only is to poetry, literature, musicians, since several years, yeah. Poets also, like Henri Chopin, Bernard Haitzig, and...
Can you say why you've had this particular interest in showing work of this sort?
Because it's my interest in art. It's the space today in art, which really I think is original and satisfies me the best.
It seems to me that the gallery has a unique identity, both in France or in Paris and in Europe. How does it sort of fit into the scene of contemporary art galleries in Paris?
Well, I think I'm very much in and out at the same time. Well, I belong to some galleries and I do things with them, but I'm very much a part too, so I'm in and out, that's exactly what I...
So tell me, we'll hear some of the sound pieces in a minute, but so tell me about this exhibition you have on at present, which in your gallery space, which is completely empty, if it weren't for the small loudspeakers connected to CD players, and sound is coming from the loudspeakers, and there's a series of loudspeakers, and it's quite low, isn't it?
He did all the balance of the... And he always does it, that you must listen to it very carefully. And even a museum director showed me how you should listen better, which is to pull your ears like that and go, so it intensifies the sound, but he always sees it very... He calls it small music.
And from where we're sitting, which is in your gallery, on two sides there are streets, and we can hear the sounds of the Paris street outside as much as we can hear the sounds coming from the loudspeakers, and presumably that balance is part of the work.
Yes, also. But it's better when we have less sounds of the street, of course.
How did you come about making this exhibition?
Well, first time I came across his work was at Documenta many years ago, and it remained in my memory, let's say. And then, when was it, 93, I organized a show called the Salon de Musique in several parts, and I think you participated too in one. And the second part was the sound sculptures, so I sent him a letter. And he sent me a small sculpture, which was called Swimming, which is a little speaker in water in a little bowl, which was very nice with recordings of nature and insects. And so after we met and we decided this show, I did the first show a year and a half ago, and this is the second show, actually.
How many pieces are in the exhibition here?
13. Well, there are three sound pieces, there are eight, because we have also graphics on the wall.
Okay, well, I think that what I'll do now is walk around, mm-hmm. and as you were saying, the way to hear it is to put your ears close to the sound source. Mm-hmm.
Like this. I mean, you can't do it, you know?
Yeah.
Behind
it. What you're doing is the gesture you're making is you're putting your hands behind your ears and moving your ear
and
lobes.
It intensifies
the sound, right. Well, I'll just try and simulate that effect with my microphone by putting it close. This piece is called
Glass,
and it's on the I suppose it's a sort of a windowsill to the window, which is to the path. So that was, in fact, there are two small loudspeakers with sound coming from them, from this piece called Glass. And on top of the speakers, in fact, there are circles, one perfectly cut and the other rather crudely cut of sort of window pane glass.
Because the glass changes the sound, that's why. You will see another piece where he has put some glasses. It directs the sound in a different way.
What is the sound we're hearing, or that we've just heard? What is its source?
This one?
You don't know?
No.
No, it's a sort of strange...
Because, you know, it takes different sounds that it makes afterwards. It's not ones, but many come from the from the nature.
All the sounds come from the natural world?
Many, yeah. But it uses also other sounds.
Okay, now we walk along the side of the gallery, and now we have two bigger loudspeakers. Sorry?
Graphite pigment?
Graphite pigment. That seems to have been tipped this sort of into the cone of the loudspeaker. Mm,
and then it moves very slowly, you know, the sound.
Oh, right. So it's a graphite
brings
powder.
Movement to the very slow movement to the pigment.
I can't hear it even bending down. Is the sound coming from this one?
It's like waterfall.
Oh yes, I can just about hear it. That piece is called Two Black Bowls, 1999.